up and hopefully it will be fine.
Okay, good evening and welcome to LSE. I'm Denisa Kostovicheva and I'm an associate professor in the Department of Government. And it is my great pleasure to introduce tonight's event that is organized by the Conflict Research Group, which is a group of scholars and students that are interested in conflict studies here at LSE. And by the Art and Reconciliation Research Project, which is a major interinstitutional project that includes King's College London, University of the Arts London, and us here at the LSE. And this project is funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council and through the Global Challenges Research Fund. We are grateful for them because what we'll be saying tonight also comes as a result of our research, and we will be very glad to share those thoughts with you. So this research project is preoccupied with the question, how can we understand reconciliation? What does reconciliation mean? And how can we evaluate reconciliation after conflict? And it has the Balkans as its main focus. Conflict Research Group is also interested in the question how justice can advance conflict resolution. So I thought it would be a good idea to sort of combine these two initiatives to organize the debate tonight. So we are going to be looking at what happens after a major international war crimes tribunal ends its work. And we know that the International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia just completed its work after nearly 25 years. And after it's made major contribution to the international law, to theorizing post-conflict justice, and it's also impacted on transitions in the countries of the former Yugoslavia. And I would suggest that it is important to debate this question for four reasons. The first one is that regardless of how contested the pursuit of justice through the ICTY has been, now that its work has finished, whoever has been in the region recently can actually see that there is a great void. It is very easy to sweep the issues of justice under the carpet, and retrospectively we can see that however contested or controversial, the work of the tribunal has offered the point for debate. Secondly, it is also clear that even more than ever that sort of what the limits of the court have been, and the fact that 2 decades after the conflict and 2 decades after the work of the tribunal, we still have thousands and thousands of victims whose suffering remains unacknowledged. Thirdly, and I would say also controversially, it shows sort of the post-ICTY situation reveals the importance of some sort of external steering and involvement in the issues of justice, precisely because we have elites that are not engaging with these issues, you could say, willingly, on one hand, but I think we also have to recognize that there is a problem at the non-elite level, given the socialization of youth into sort of the ethnic-centric narratives through the education. And lastly, given that we are debating these issues in London, and we know that London will be hosting the summit of the Berlin process in July, and we know that legacy issues are going to be a part of the agenda of the summit, I thought it would be very good to have a debate to try to sort of air some issues before the summit. So I would say that it is no overstatement to say that we have an amazing panel of speakers tonight. And sort of in the interest of time, I would do something sort of rather unconventional and introduce them collectively as a group of scholars who have shaped, deepened, and challenged the thinking on transitional justice in the Balkans, but also contributed to the theorizing of post-conflict transitions from the perspective of justice-seeking more generally. I think it would be much better to listen to them speak than spend the next 20 minutes at least going through their distinguished contributions. But just to say that it is my great pleasure to welcome Jasna Dragović-Sosa, who is joining us from Goldsmiths, Jelena Petrović, who is also our contributor to the Arts Project. She is based at King's. Professor James Gao, also from King's, and also a collaborator on the Arts and Reconciliation Project. To my left is Professor Eric Gordy from School of Slavonic and Southeast European Studies, and Professor Jelena Subotic, that is, who is joining us from Georgia State University. Please give them a warm welcome. Okay, so I've asked each speaker to speak about 7 minutes, and I'll try to enforce those 7 minutes, and this will give us plenty of time for debate between the sort of speakers on the panel and with the audience. Jasna, over to you.
Okay, all right, so I'm going to launch this discussion. Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really pleased to be here with such a distinguished panel of experts. And basically, since I've been asked to speak first, what I will do very briefly, and I know Denisa will cut me off, is introduce the idea of reconciliation, talk a little bit about the Hague Tribunal and its contribution, and then finish off by raising what I think are some important questions in terms of where do we go from here. So very briefly, as I think many of you are aware, the term reconciliation is a hugely contested one. It means different things to different people, and interpretations range from basically meaning things like peaceful coexistence to something that is akin to forgiveness and absolution to, perhaps more cynically, something you put on a form if you are an NGO requesting funding from the EU. It is a highly loaded term without a universally accepted definition, and some authors viewing it as an endpoint, others focusing on it more as a process that relates to things, again, very vague and abstract, such as truth, justice, reparation, apology, and so on, that attempts to address the legacy of past conflict. Recognizing this ambiguity in the term, I have opted for Kevin Abrug's definition of reconciliation as being the process of constructing, I'm quoting, at least minimally shared and probably much more than minimally shared, narratives of the past and visions of the future. Now, this definition allows for multiple truths rather than a single grand narrative about the past and its meaning. But as he notes, at the very least, one must be willing to recognize the other's truth as part of one's own narrative. In other words, it implies that there is a degree of legitimacy that is accorded to truths of others with whom one is in conflict or disagreement. And as many scholars have argued, this implies a level of dialogue and deliberation and an essential openness to the multiplicity of experiences which, while different maybe from one's own, are nevertheless recognizable and legitimate. And so it is perhaps no surprise that, as such, reconciliation as a concept is both a liberal and a constructivist project. So has the Hague Tribunal contributed to reconciliation? Now, unlike the ICTR, its sister tribunal, for Rwanda, the ICTY did not actually explicitly have in its mandate this notion of seeking to promote reconciliation in the region. However, despite this, the ICTY was clearly imbued with the same kind of liberal mission. In other words, to contribute to something akin to reconciliation in the region through justice and truth-telling. And this was evident in the many statements issued by its advocates and endorsers, you know, officials, practitioners, and also some scholars. And it was imbued, in addition to its judicial tasks, with tasks of constructing a historical record, preventing forgetting and denial of crimes, individualizing guilt, and promoting not just justice, but also the construction of an authoritative narrative about the conflicts of the 1990s and the crimes committed. Now, the extent to which the ICTY has successfully completed this rather ambitious, and in my view, overambitious mission, continues to be a matter of debate. The tribunal has certainly built a voluminous historical record and has impacted the development of international law and perhaps to a lesser degree legal practice in the region. However, I think that it is fair to say that in terms of promoting reconciliation along the lines described, it has not succeeded, either in establishing an authoritative narrative, account of the past, nor in individualizing guilt and countering collective nationalist myths, nor indeed in preventing denial and forgetting in the region. While there is evidence that the space for denial has somewhat shrunk as a result of its work, to use Diane Orenblicher's term, notably when it comes to Srebrenica, for example, ultimately there has been no serious official or societal reckoning with any of these events or crimes. There have been moments of debate and some official apologies, but these have been partial at best and without a broader public resonance. To the contrary, I think what pretty much all analyses are showing at the moment is that the situation may in fact be worse now than it was some 15 or 20 years ago. But at the end of the tribunal's existence, fewer people in opinion polls state that they know what happened and are able to name crimes, even when those crimes are committed against their own national group. While we're also seeing a resurgence of nationalist myth-making and right-wing activity, which is accompanied by an astounding ignorance of and disregard for the suffering of others by political leaders in the region. So the last few minutes I will just spend by saying, where do we go from here? And I've basically come up with sort of four things that I think are important to take into account. The first point is that processes of dealing with the past are necessarily internal and intra-regional. They're not something that can be imported from outside. In other words, reconciliation, or whatever you want to call it, needs domestic agency, and without it, it doesn't happen. Secondly, I would argue that one ingredient of this kind of work needs to be the construction of a public official repository of key facts about the conflicts of the 1990s and the crimes committed, which will then act as a basis for public deliberation and debate. Now, this is not the same as constructing an authoritative narrative, which contains explanations about causation, intent, and responsibility, and so on. Rather, a repository of facts would include things like the numbers and names of people killed in the conflicts and the circumstances of their death, the location of detention centers, who controlled them, what happened there, etc., the numbers and names of those who are still missing, and so on. Now, this knowledge exists to some degree, and it has been compiled not only by the ICTY, but also local and international NGOs and civil society actors over many years. However, this information, while publicly available, has not achieved either official recognition or widespread acceptance. And this is precisely what one of the projects in the region is seeking to do now. Now, just to qualify this point, even if this were to happen and you could actually agree on a set of shared facts, this does not necessarily lead to shared truths. But I personally do not see this as a problem. In fact, I would argue that this is inherent to the nature of public debate and history writing. The important thing is that there is a public space in which interpretations and arguments can be placed under scrutiny, debated, and contested through an informed, fact-based dialogue, which is not what we have today. The third important thing, and I'll be very brief, is something that would contribute to rehumanizing the other. In other words, the fostering and creation of empathy across ethnic, racial, or religious affiliations. And there are different ways of doing this. There are transitional justice mechanisms, of course, but there's also an important role to be played by culture and the media in telling human stories, powerful human stories, and generating an understanding and empathy with other people. And my final point concerns what I call embeddedness, for the lack of a better word, of reconciliation processes in a broader context. Based on both the historical analysis of the region and other cases, I would argue that reconciliation can neither be imposed from above, as for example in socialist Yugoslavia, nor can it simply take place from below without the existence of a propitious political and socioeconomic context. And this is made up of, above all, a consolidated democracy, a well-functioning media space, a vibrant civil society, and I think this has been increasingly recognized, a level of economic prosperity and stability. Simply put, people will not deal with thorny questions about the past if they're living with a sense of constant fear and precarity about existential basic needs. And if there are to be any real prospects for reconciliation in the region, then it needs to be understood that this doesn't come from isolation from these broader political and socioeconomic trends.
Thank you, Yasna. Yeah.
So I will now take over. I do apologize for everyone sitting behind me. Do feel free to interrupt me if you can't hear what I'm saying. As Denise said, I take part in this project on art and reconciliation. My job actually is to map out the reconciliation-related projects in the Balkans and to gain additional information through a series of interviews with the intended beneficiaries, practitioners, but also donors in the region as to how does it all work in practice, how is reconciliation understood, to which level there is a kind of common understanding of reconciliation, not only within the region or within individual countries, but also within organizations, and finally to research what kind of methods of evaluation are applied to assess the contribution that these reconciliation-related projects are making to the actual process or a goal. And I will spend my 6.5 minutes now talking just a little bit about some of the results, more indications, because the research is still ongoing, so I can't really call them full and final results, about what kind of place this transitional justice project take within the wider scope of reconciliation-related projects in the region. But I will then dedicate a little bit more time to some of the key issues, which may not be as well-structured as Yasna's, but I just thought that I should throw out some provocative thoughts that I've encountered doing a series of interviews and in hope that I will stimulate a discussion. So let me just begin by saying that one of the first things that I've encountered doing this research is that while obviously there is no such thing as a common understanding of what reconciliation is, there is also very wide differentiation how different organizations understand transitional justice. And even when you would see that they have adopted a certain definition of what transitional justice is, it would vary quite wildly in their implementation as to what they would label as transitional justice projects. So you would find a range of projects that in one country are labeled transitional justice, and they would include projects such as raising the awareness of the general population about the war crimes committed. You would find training of members of the judiciary labeled a transitional justice project, but you would also find projects aimed to provide support to victims of conflict labeled transitional justice, whereas in another country, some of these would be labeled something completely different. So, for example, the training of judges would be labeled education, support to victims would be labeled human rights. So it is also a question, it's not just which definition did we adopt on a theoretical level, but how would we apply them in practice, and to what extent there is a standardization of this approach throughout the region. Obviously, the place of transitional justice, when I started doing the project, I expected that the portion of transitional justice-related projects within overall reconciliation would be relatively large, or that it would be fairly similar between different organizations. What I have found is that they also kind of differ very wildly, ranging from 1.32% of some organizations going all the way to 52% with other organizations, depending on their priorities. But the number, and this is just basically the ratio of number of projects labeled transitional justice to the total number of reconciliation labeled projects. But if you look at the financial scale of these projects, you get a completely different different picture. So you can see that, for example, the organizations such as Robert Bosch Foundation, which is one of the more active donors in the region, will set aside, even though it will have only 1.32% of its projects being labeled transitional justice, it will set aside 10% of its budget for the region for transitional justice-related projects. It does make you think as to what extent do these organizations value, but it also, when you look into teams that they're dealing with and who are they working with, that you get a much better picture of how much money is it all costing and how much money is actually going into the region to address transitional justice issues and what the place of transitional justice is within reconciliation as perceived by the donors. And that brings me to much more, for me at least, interesting topics, and there's controversies here. So what extent do donors dictate what will be addressed within transitional justice labeled projects? Whether there are taboo issues that civil society organizations are not daring to raise. And interviewing in March, I spent some time in Kosovo, in Pristina, and I interviewed members of people working for NGOs there. And a lot of them raised, for example, this thing that they don't feel like that they can raise or submit a project that would deal with the justice for the civilian victims of NATO campaign 1999, because they, for example, perceive that as a taboo topic and that they're not allowed to raise it in fear that they would be cut off funding completely. So for me, it was a surprise. I was expecting to hear a similar story doing a series of interviews in Serbia, where that is a big issue, the civilians victims of 1999 campaign. But I was quite surprised to hear it so wildly accepted by the civilians society organizations in Kosovo. Other thing is that you were absolutely right, Yasin, when you pointed out it's a lot about the living standards and the vibrant need for the vibrant civil society, but the civil society in the Balkans depends on external donors. Mm-hmm. And without the support, financial support of the external donors, there is no vibrant civil society in the Balkans, and there is no dealing with these topics, because in order to deal with these topics, they're not going to get the money from the governments of the regional countries. They have to rely upon the external donors, which gives external donors also the power what will be addressed, but also, as a lot of interviews pointed out, the feeling in the region is that there was a deadline on reconciliation and transitional justice. And again, this is an insight specifically from my series of Kosovo interviews, that the feeling among the civil society organizations there is that one day someone just woke up and said, okay, it's been 10 years since the conflict, you should all be reconciled by now. If you're not reconciled, we're moving on. There are hotter topics. There are other things that we need to address. We are going to redistribute the funding, and we want you to address these other issues, which is forcing the organizations to relabel their approaches, relabel their projects, if they want to actually survive, and it's dragging the attention away from what actually needs to be addressed in the transitional justice and reconciliation related projects. And finally, then there is obviously the last thing I wanted to mention is this entire issue of evaluation of impact, which we discussed also earlier today, and that is who is to say that these projects actually work? Who is to say, whose job is it to come and say that these projects, reconciliation, transitional justice related, are actually making a change, which methods are being used there? And another one of the findings so far is this, or at least a question that needs to be answered, is that it is not so much who and which methods are used, but actually who's using the methods and which consideration, especially political consideration or economical consideration, are playing into these evaluations as they're being conducted. To what extent are those evaluations of impacts made by these projects are truthful and are actually fully reliable, and to what extent they are based upon the evaluators' need to secure their next gig with the same organization. And I think I still have time?
No.
I tried too much.
That's great, but lots of ideas there to take up in the discussion. Eric.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. And I'd like to thank Denisa for inviting us, and also to thank James for wearing a necktie so that I don't feel out of place. And thanks to you, too. We don't know each other, but thanks. okay, so the first part of the title of the panel is After the Hague Tribunal, and that means that one of the things we're expected to do is give some kind of assessment of the tribunal. So I'll offer an assessment in a word, is that it has produced a record that is mixed. That is, they've made some good decisions, they've made some bad decisions, and this is about normal for a judicial institution. You know, it's up to us as researchers to go back on that and make individual assessments and consider a broader context. But this being the sort of uncontroversial case, we might ask, why is it that this record was produced in the first place? That is, what is the point of engaging criminal trials in a post-conflict context? And what I might want to suggest is that for those of us who are not part of the legal profession, that there are four main goals. The first reason that that you would want to hold criminal trials is to provide a performative example of the establishment of the rule of law over a field of behavior. A second reason is to use the process of presentation and discussion and contestation and assessment of evidence to establish facts about the conflict, to create a record of what happened. And here I want to make a distinction. That is, that a factual record of the conflict is not the same as the legal interpretation of that factual record. And one of the fascinating things in looking at a lot of judicial findings is looking at the way that some of the factual findings appear to be inconsistent with the legal conclusions. The third reason that this is why the term reconciliation comes to be used as problematic as that term is that a legal trial is a way of intervening in the process of social communication and of developing an understanding of what's usually the recent past in which violence happened. And then finally, the fourth reason is institutional. It's hoped that a groundwork will be laid in terms of establishing facts, in terms of encouraging the development of institutions, in terms of providing experience for further legal work. That is, for further efforts to explore the past. Now, if these are the four goals of engaging in criminal trials, we might want to ask some questions about these goals. First, about establishing the rule of law. Is this something that that the states in the region are seriously interested in doing? Is it something that powerful international actors are seriously interested in doing? With regard to establishing facts, we might also ask some questions. We might ask, how far do facts travel? And what is the path between the writing of facts into an evidentiary record and the use of those facts in acts of establishing and sharing public consciousness? With regard to social communication, we might want to ask, what is the landscape of social communication? What kinds of roles do legal institutions play in building that landscape? And how do they compete with other types of institutions, especially cultural, educational, and religious institutions? In terms of developing further legal work, we might want to ask, what are the prospects for advancement of further legal work? Now, on most of these points, there would be grounds to give some fairly pessimistic answers in terms of will and the prospects for future development and so on. But these are this is an understanding that's well established. If you were to ask why there is ground for pessimism, probably there are too many reasons coming from too many sources. That is, it's sort of overdetermined. But we might also want to say that some pessimism is overstated. One of the things that that we have seen is that the articulation of need goes on despite the lack of satisfaction of needs that are produced by violence through legal institutions, and the absence of meeting of needs is an emerging problem in research. It's one that's been addressed in the doctoral research, for example, by Daniela Lai, who's right there. Hi, Daniela. We might also point out that that although it looks like denial is very much in vogue, there is movement that we don't always notice. So if we want to talk, for example, about debates over Srebrenica, right now the debate over Srebrenica is between whether that set of events is going to be labeled as genocide, which is what the tribunal has found, and is a position articulated especially by victims groups, or whether it is, on the other hand, a terrible crime, which seems now to be the official position of, for example, the governments of Serbia and Republika Srpska. Now, this is a definition of technical elements to be settled among lawyers, and it is a much, much smaller difference than the difference that we saw 10 or 15 years ago between the contention that something happened and that nothing happened. So one of the things that we need to understand is that dialogue is taking place, understanding is developing, but it's not developing in the way that was predicted at the beginning. It's not developing in mechanistic ways. And there's been good research showing some of the unpredictable ways in which these discourses developed. Research by people like Jelena Obradovic and by Ivor Sokolic, who have looked at this in Serbia and Croatia respectively. But still, probably the reason that that a pessimistic approach still dominates is that it's recognizable that a dogmatic interpretation of the past and a fear of a factual confrontation with the past remains dominant, and that this dogma and this fear are both perfectly well in correspondence with the renewed entrenchment of authoritarian regimes. What I would argue regarding the landscape of social communication is that the shortcomings in the development of social communication show some of the limitations of an approach that has been centered on technically legal issues, on criminal trials, and on communications between sets of elites. That is a process that has not involved the public to a large degree. And I'll make a final point. That is, if we want to make an assessment of the various criminal trials and the activity that surrounded criminal trials. This has already been suggested by Jasna, but I'm going to make the point too because Jasna's right. That is that the greatest contribution of this set of activity is not going to be the judicial decisions and the various legal interpretations that have been produced through institutions, but it's going to be the archive that has been produced, especially by the investigators, which will provide a broad documentary record that's going to be open to interpretation from various points of view. I'll end by saying I got this question from a journalist in Sarajevo, where I tried to make the point that that the greatest contribution is the archive. And the journalist said, "Well, aren't you afraid about people approaching this archive and making tendentious or partial interpretations?" My answer was no. If somebody makes a tendentious or a partial interpretation, somebody else will come, use the same material, and make another interpretation. And this is how discussion develops. This is how knowledge is generated, and this is how understanding takes place. And it's probably better than the attempt to rely on authority in the form of a court, which has been the main center of activity so far. I think I'll end with that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Yeah,
hi. Yeah, please don't ask me to have an optimistic account after. I'll leave everybody else for that. I've never said anything optimistic in my life. I'm not going to start tonight. Genetically incapable of that. So what I want to talk about briefly is placing the ICTY in a political environment, in a political context. And it really builds up very nicely of what Eric just talked about, which is the way in which this court was appreciated or not appreciated and evaluated as a political institution when in fact it's a legal institution, and a huge mismatch between the expectations that the court was burdened on that were political versus what it could actually accomplish, which is legal. And I think part of the problem here arises simply from a kind of philosophical mismatch between the job of the court, which is to provide individual criminal accountability, but for group crimes. So the court is prosecuting a very, very, very small subset of individuals for mass crimes that were group crimes that were done by groups against groups. And the whole point of the court was to provide individual criminal accountability so that it could avoid collective guilt and collective responsibility. But there's a paradox in here as well. And the paradox is, again, building nicely on what was already said, in the fact that the court itself, and this cannot be overstated, it's a legal institution. So the burden of evidence in front of the court is a completely different kind than the burden of evidence that would be in a political sense. So the court is able to evaluate a very discrete type of evidence of one individual on the docket. This has nothing to do with establishing what happened in Bosnia. This has to do with establishing what this person did in this village in Bosnia in 1993. And then the leap was made between prosecuting this one person and whatever evidence is discovered in this one case towards something larger. And the problem with that is not the problem of the court. The problem is that there was nothing else going on in society, so the court had to do everything. So the court is kind of a lonely institution floating around, and it became the only mechanism of transitional justice for a very long time. It was not supposed to be that way. It was supposed to be, there were supposed to be truth commissions. There were supposed to be domestic war crimes prosecutions, which exist, of course, but are, again, operating in very contested, they exist in Bosnia and in Serbia and Croatia, not so much. And even in Bosnia and Croatia, they exist within a larger, incredibly hostile political environment. Okay. So the problem with the court in some ways and all the disappointments of that the court brought in and all the, you know, pessimistic assessments of the mixed record have to do with really unrealistic and institutionally inappropriate expectations that were provided and given and burdened onto the court because there was nothing else. The court was the only game in town when it comes to writing the historical record and providing transitional justice. So what I think this points to is that instead of looking at the concept of post-conflict justice as having kind of three separate elements, the individual responsibility, state responsibility, and societal responsibility, and I'll say a few words about each, all we got was individual responsibility. So the way that I see the larger universe of responsibilities when it comes to war crimes, not just in the former Yugoslavia but elsewhere, is in these three elements. The individual responsibility is obviously important. Individuals who have committed crimes or have ordered the commission of crimes or were aware of crimes but didn't do anything, of course they should be prosecuted. But that to me is the easiest part of this whole thing. State responsibility is a step forward. It is the state that can provide official apologies. It is the state that can provide reparations, a word which we have not mentioned yet, which are needed. And the reparations can be financial, they can be symbolic, they can be political. It's the state that will rename the streets. You know, there should be a street, or it should be a square, and there should be a monument in the center of Belgrade to the genocide of Srebrenica. Okay? That's never going to happen, but we know why. But that's something the state should offer. That's not something that the court should offer, and in Zagreb and elsewhere. Yeah, can you imagine how that would look? I want to go there for the unveiling. Like, I just want to go there for the unveiling. And then the third and the most controversial is the societal responsibility. And this is, you know, people confuse the societal responsibility for mass atrocity with collective guilt. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that people have also labeled memory solidarity. So being able to have solidarity with others, it's empathy. And it's also an understanding that you, as a citizen of a country, bear moral responsibility for what the government did in your name. And this is completely missing. And again, this is not just the ICTY or the Yugoslav problem. This is missing in conflicts everywhere. But this is an incredibly important element of a larger universe of post-conflict justice. And again, this is something that everybody expected the ICTY to provide, reconciliation, that, you know, Serbs will see what was done to Bosniaks and they will somehow change the narrative about the Bosnian War. And that's not something that the court was able to do. So I want to just say one more thing, and then I'm really looking forward to James and then the questions, and that is, why is memory solidarity so hard? What is it about admitting that crimes were done by your group against another group? Why does that foreclose the space for your acknowledging of your own group suffering? I mean, it seems like a banal question, but it is at the crux of this problem. Why is it so difficult to acknowledge and provide some kind of address for horrific crimes that were done with your tax money by the government that you may have supported or that you may have opposed, but it was still a group crime. People were killed in the name of your group and suffered tremendously. And I think without understanding the process of post-conflict justice as the process that really has to involve solidarity with others, discussions about, you know, the legal shortcomings of the ICTY, I think, are misplaced. One final point, I think, I said it was my final point, I have a real final point now. I think a lot of the problems with the way in which the ICTY appeared as a political actor and an actor of transitional justice is in way in which sentencing and punishment was doled out. I think it was a very difficult process to watch, to see how sentences were inflated over time. Because by the time we were done with the ICTY, everybody was getting plea bargain out, and you could be sentenced for many fewer years in prison if you had committed a mass crime against humanity than if you were a shoplifter. And that one single point is not lost on the families of victims, but also on everybody. And there's something profoundly broken in leaving the entire system of post-conflict justice up to a bench of international judges whose incentive is to clear the docket as quickly before their budget falls out. And I think that just looking at, like, if you just do, like, an analysis of what has happened with sentencing over time, that provides a real big problem. The ICTY's big contribution, in my view, is that it was like a big vacuum that sucked out the worst dirt, but it then spit Voice of Sheshield right back at us. And that is not something that, again, I think we should blame the court for. I think we should look at what kind of a political environment exists in a country that can welcome and put back in a political system somebody accused of some of the worst mass crimes in the second part of the 20th century. Done.
And James.
Well, it's impossible to follow Yelena.
I hear that a lot.
I'm tempted to say, shall we just go to questions?
No.
I politely refuse.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's a cop out.
Because, well,
he served his time.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it is very difficult following four excellent, richly informed, detailed presentations. I find myself sitting here rather exposed and inadequate. And I'm going to offer briefly a personal reflection, starting 25 years ago this month with the UN Security Council's authorizing the creation of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, as has been said, amid an implicit atmosphere that somehow doing this kind of stuff, among other things, would lead to reconciliation. This was informed by readings of the International Military Tribunals for Nuremberg, at Nuremberg and Tokyo at the end of the Second World War. False readings in the case of Tokyo, but that's a thing. And in a sense, a false reading in terms of Nuremberg, because as time has gone on, looking at the role and impact of the Yugoslavia Tribunal, you can see how much else was needed in the context of the transformation of Germany and the reconciliation beyond the process of having a tribunal. And that's been missing. There have been bits here and there, some of the projects to which Yelena refers to, people taking initiatives, belatedly, the Yugoslavia Tribunal itself developing an outreach capability to try and transmit and connect and communicate. But really, although it was created by politics for a political purpose, a lot of the time, in the end, all it could do, as Yelena was saying, was its judicial business. Speak to some of the prosecutors, and they would say, my job is only to run a good prosecution, not even to get a conviction, just to run a good prosecution and make the process work. No time for any of that wider mission stuff. And this leaves us in a situation where prospects for reconciliation, whatever that means and at what level, for the most part, are not great. Those who have experience of Bosnia and Herzegovina in particular will sympathize with my experience a couple of years ago, but all the more relevant now, giving a lecture in Sarajevo at the university, which is no longer a mixed environment, but is now a predominantly Muslim environment, Bosniak environment, reflecting the Sarajevo canton. About the great success of Bosnian defense reform and being pulled down by my audience. How can you call this a success? Because the idea of speaking to a European security agenda and having integration was false. My audience asked me, how could I say this? Because if Republika Srpska declared independence, this army would do nothing. More curiously, it said, when Croatia invades, which shows how out of touch in some ways they must be, this army will fall apart. which seems to me the completely to be missing the points that we would expect, people like me would expect. And I think instead we see febrile material that, if there were not an international presence, would lead to a return to armed hostilities within 18 months or so, which is not a good record for any of the international initiatives, but it's also a case for keeping going. So this is, as has been said already, it's a fairly dismal prospect for quite a lot of investment. We're given the mission of talking about something after the Hague Tribunal, and I questioned what that means. Obviously it means after the end of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, but actually a tribunal continues in The Hague. The business of the Yugoslavia Tribunal had not actually finished. It's been handed over to the mechanism of the International Criminal Tribunals. There are still issues there, both of record and of impact, that might affect questions of reconciliation one way or the other. We talk about agreed facts. We talk about the judicial record. But we know, at least some of us know, some of us believe, that some of those things are not the way they should be, even though the court has said that they are. Only last week, the mechanism heard part of the Karadzic appeals process, which is continuing. One of the points the defense is seeking to make is that Karadzic was not party to the decision for mass murder at Srebrenica. I happen to think that's absolutely right. I think the record has been wrong about that. If that comes out in some way to be the case, what impact will that have on people who already think that not enough has been done, that sentencing is not enough, that the verdicts have not been of the right kind? On the other side of that, on a mild note of optimism, I look at the prospects for the appeal in the Mladic case, where the initial trial chamber judgment has left the seed for a possibility that on appeal, and let's not count any chickens, but there's a seed to follow there, that there might finally be a genocide conviction in relation to the events in northern and eastern Bosnia in 1992 and 93. The trial chamber couldn't quite bring itself to go all that way, but it took some steps forward. And I think that's very important in terms of broad level political reconciliation, social reconciliation, whatever that might be. Because I do think if that finding were to emerge, and it won't emerge for this reason, it'll only emerge because the judges evaluate evidence in a particular way, that would puncture, that's my 30-second warning, would puncture the sense that justice has not been done. And I think overall, despite the largely successful record of the tribunal, the sense that justice has not been done remains, and because that remains, the prospects of reconciliation in most cases at a social and political level are negligible. One final point of small encouragement and optimism is that maybe the most, I've come to think, the most that we can hope for is that individuals, maybe groups, can be reconciled themselves to their own awful fates. And in this moment, I think of the mother in the case of Dragan Nikolic, who sits in the courtroom and speaks directly to Nikolic and says, "All I want to know is what happened to my sons." And Nikolic says, "As I understand it, they were taken to that hill. They were shot and they buried." And in that moment, you see a mother coming to terms finally with her own experience. Whether or not we can justify the investment in international prosecutions to achieve that, I don't know. But it means that it's, for all the dismal stuff, there are positive things that can be taken.
Thank you, James. Well, thank you to everyone. Gosh, we visited issues ranging from how we understand reconciliation, how it's done, why it's done in a particular way. We've looked at tribunal inside, how it's done, how it's projected what it's doing, how it's changed the sort of the deliberative landscape locally, etc., etc. So I'll just invite you now to ask questions, and then we'll see how it goes. Maybe we'll have a little mini debate within the panel. Please, we have a roving mic. Please introduce yourself first, and please ask a question, not make comments. Yeah, there's a question there.
Thank you very much for the for this panel. It's really, truly wonderful. I have some questions for Jelena and Eric. For Jelena, my question is about, I was really fascinated by your ideas about, I'm from SOAS, University of London, by the way, about individual responsibility, society responsibility, and state responsibility. But my question is about society responsibility. How do you make it happen? How do you make a society to act without the participation of the state? You see my point, because for me it's like very, very much related to the action of the state. And my question for Eric, it's about the archive. It caught my attention about the importance that you give to the archive, but I have two questions for you. One, I don't know because this is not my expertise, but about the legal implications to have an archive for the future and to have investigation and research. What about the victims that participated and they were not expecting people to have access to this archive in the future? And also, how can, as researchers and scholars and so on, how can we trust in archive when we know that in many countries, post-conflict states, also the leaders, they might also manipulate archive files can get lost, or information also can be modified. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll just collect a few questions.
So another question about the archive.
Oh,
sorry. My name is Henry Redwood. I'm on the Art and Rec project at King's with Denise and James and Yelena. A question so about the archive, which is I would first of all push back against Yelena's skepticism about the value of the archive, and I think especially if you move beyond the judicial case files, there's a lot of richness within the archives of international courts.
Yes, there wasn't.
I sort of got the sense that you said that they were...
Archives are great.
Okay, right, well then,
love
great. But I guess my point, an additional point was, how is the archive perceived within the region, and what is the current sense about ownership over the archive, and who is using it, and to what effect? Because I think there's a general tendency that that having an archive is sufficient in and of itself to sort of have a successful legacy, when in actual fact archives are often very good at allowing forgetting to happen, and that's what Pierre Nora's work about Le de Memoir sort of warns us about. And then I guess leading from that to Yasna's point about the need for a factual repository of facts, neutral facts that are sort of accepted by all sides, and why do we need this in light of the ICTY's archive? And if we do need it in light of the ICTY's archive, what mechanisms would be used to construct this? Because I think that whilst it seems like a very simple thing, like if you look at debates between legal parties at the start of cases that sort of try and narrow down the contested facts of the case, just establishing simple things about numbers or victim sites or ownership of certain centres, I would imagine would be very contested.
I also have a question that is. Yes, I'm Daniela Lai, based here at LSE. I think my question is I mean, anyone, it's really for everyone, but it was prompted by Yelena's presentation. As I'm looking more into the role of economic actors in post-war justice processes, I was wondering whether you had any thought about where corporate responsibility would fit in the idea of post-war, of responsibility in post-war justice being individual, at the individual state or social level. Like, do you think, where would you see corporate responsibility fit in this?
Okay, thank you. Who would like to start? When there are questions for the whole panel, or James, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, but the questions were to them, just because I want to answer them.
So your question, you're totally right. So the question was, can you have societal responsibility without state? And no, because in the way that I'm imagining this, the state provides a political environment in which societal responsibility becomes possible. In other words, if the space politically is closed, even if you have the best intentions, you cannot go there. And I mean, of course, this is this framework that I presented is wishful thinking. It's very hard to think of societies that have gone through all three in a satisfactory manner. And that's, you know, everybody always says, nobody has ever done that, so, you know. But, you know, a girl can dream. So I can, you know, imagine like a best scenario in which I... To give an illustration of what I want to see. So what I want to see is something like how in Berlin, people of your generation, students, rent an apartment, and they want to find out who lived in that apartment, and they go to the archive. Oh, even though they're not related to, there's not a family relationship to the Holocaust, but they want to know, are they living in somebody's apartment who lived there and was killed? So they go to the publicly available archives in Germany, and they build a little Stolperstein, a little stumbling stone. They pay for it. It's called 350 euros. And they want to mark themselves, they're 25-year-old Germans, who lived in the apartment and where the people were taken. That is societal responsibility for mass atrocity. Now, again, I don't want to get into Germany's not ideal case. Germany's tilting rightward. Yes. But, you know, this is what I would like to see. But that is part of a state responsibility that has already been demonstrated by Germany. Okay. So, but there are other smaller, discrete ways. There's a role of teachers in education. There's a role of academics. There's a way in which you can research topics, even in political environments that may not be particularly permissive. And that's what's missing. And that goes to the second question. On the archives. Archives, wonderful, fantastic, love archives. Have a paper on archives tomorrow, Denise. Archives are the best. What I want to see is, are students in Serbia or Croatia going to use the archives to write their PhD dissertations at University of Belgrade and University of Zagreb? Are they going to be PhD advisors who are going to supervise those kinds of dissertations? So the issue is not, the archives are phenomenal. The issue is, again, the political space that's open for that kind of research. And some will, some won't. Academic community is very divided in both Croatia and Serbia. There's a left and a right. But it's not immediately obvious to me that they will be used in a way that we want them to be used. Not in terms of abuse, but just in terms of indifference. We have not mentioned indifference here. It's not maybe even denial. It's just like, so what? And that's, in some ways, it's worse, actually. That's what I'm worried about. Who wants to talk about, corporate?
Well, there is archives, there's...
Yeah. So somebody...
There is...
Archive in response to... The question there, and maybe you can come in there.
Factual accounts.
Yes, factual
accounts.
That's good. Okay, so thanks. That's a really good question. So why is the ICTUI archive not enough, basically, is the first question. And then the second one is the facts themselves can be contested, right? Those are two sort of prongs
not
of the question.
ICTUI, if there's an issue with that, then
what else? Okay. Yeah, sure. So, first of all, I would agree that the ICTR ICTY archive is hugely important, and that it covers a lot of important crimes, it uncovers a lot of details and so on, and access to it is key. However, it is an archive of a tribunal, which in some sense means that, A, it doesn't cover everything that happened in all the crimes, but only those that were adjudicated by it. And secondly, it doesn't focus so much on the experience of those who were the victims of those crimes as much as it focuses on proving the guilt and innocence of those who are accused. And therefore, there is a lot of evidence out there that still needs to be gathered about what happened to people in different localities that is not necessarily something that's been dealt with by the ICTY. Now, how has this been done? I mean, there are groups of civil society actors, NGOs in the region that have been doing this kind of work. I mean, just recently, Denisa and Eric and I were in Sarajevo to see some of the results of this kind of work. And I must say, it is actually pretty phenomenal what's been done so far in terms of identifying people by name, by the way that they were killed, the locality, where, what ethnicity, basic facts about the person. And by looking at these individual fates, you're actually getting micro-histories of, you know, specific localities, and you're understanding, you know, the multiplicity of the various aspects of this conflict in the region. So there are actually projects going on. There is a broader project to bring this work together, which is called the Coalition for RECOM, the Regional Commission Initiative, which actually seeks to create a fact-finding regional commission that will reunite this kind of work, that will conduct its own investigations and its own testimonies, and that will then provide such a universal repository of facts. Now, this brings me to the second point, which is that the facts themselves, of course, are going to be contested. I think, again, like Eric, this is inevitable. Facts, truths, everything is contested. But so what? It's better to have them than not to have them. And, you know, in a way, you will get contestation, and that's part of public dialogue. But if we look at other cases, having these kinds of fact-based commissions, tribunals, etc., does actually then inform research, inform debate, and that outright disagreement about facts, not about their interpretations, becomes narrowed over time. So that's what I'm
looking for.
Yeah.
Okay,
am I supposed
to go now? Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Let me begin by saying a bit about archives. And since both Jelena and Jasna have talked about archives, I'll make just three really quick points about archives. Okay. One. The discovery of facts from the archive that could lead to further criminal responsibility. There are some protections against this, and identities that are protected usually remain protected at least as long as the person whose identity it is alive and can be prosecuted. But the fact is this could happen. People could be made vulnerable. I mean, as I think you probably know, in Argentina and in Chile, in both places, they've tried repeated times to put moratoria on prosecution. And there's a whole NGO sector with well-trained lawyers who spend years and years mostly successfully destroying those moratoria on prosecutions. This is a fact that doesn't bother me much. On the question of the bias of archives, yeah, okay, look. Every archive, as Jasna says, has limitations, and every archive also has a particular character, a particular bias, as you could call it, in terms of what is collected, in terms of what's foregrounded, what's made easy to find, and what's made more difficult to find. There's a whole debate on this in methodology. This archive is no different. So this is a fact that has to be taken into account. I mean, one way I could possibly respond to this is by describing my dream archive. because you have the Tribunal archive, which is enormous. You also have the archives of journalism following the cases, especially the Sense Agency, which is opening up its documentation centers around around the region, and all of the non-governmental organizations that were trying to promote cases and provide evidence to governments and to the Tribunal have their archives. So my dream archive is one that's going to bring all of those things together and invite people to contribute more, so that there is a collection that is living and expanding, that's in use. And as Yelena pointed out, what we also need is people to use them. One of the great failures of the advocates of justice and reconciliation has probably been the failure to produce a second generation, people who will build on the knowledge and carrying on the work. And this is something that that should be addressed. Now to Daniela. Okay, Daniela, you asked about corporate responsibility. And I mean, some of the responsibility that we're talking about is corporate responsibility, but what I think is important, and I know that you know this, is that the war was in many respects an economic activity, and it was an activity of producing the class of wealthy people through the accumulation that happened partly through violence, partly through smuggling, and other sorts of dealings, who would form the core of you know, what is now the neoliberal elite in all of the states in the region, right? I mean, Peter Andreas, in his book on smuggling in Sarajevo during the time of the blockade, has made this point eloquently. And I mean, it would be easy to expand that research to the other states, because we know about things like the dealing in stolen refrigerators and
art, all the plundered art.
Oh, and art, yes, if we want to include Croatia in there. And about the openly declared plans to use the period of instability to create, for example, in Croatia, it was a declared goal to create an elite of 200 very wealthy families who would form the core of the future state. So, you know, I mean, you want to go back, I'll take you back to the good old days of Marxist theory and Arnold Hauser and all of that, right? I mean, this is the story that's being told. It's the use of violence and theft and crime to create a new elite, and that's a story that is largely untold. It goes beyond, you know, the story of violence creating human needs that can be addressed through reparations, and into the story of social justice and the way that new social orders are constructed. So yeah, the foundation is there, and how you get anyone to do anything about it, it'll probably happen at about the same time that we dismantle the old aristocracy in this country.
Okay, so James and Yelena would like to make a point, but just because you're talking about the economic issues, so I'll just continue on that note. So yes, the conflict was, as some scholars would call it, right, a mutual enterprise, right, with parties sort of conflict as a profit-making, having no interest to seize it. But what is very interesting when we talk about transitional justice is that these issues continue. So you have cases now in Bosnia, for example. We know that there are many sites, many people are looking for the missing, right? So there are lots of sites where, you know, that exist, and that sort of the families of those who are still missing cannot find. So there have been quite a few cases recently where families found out about these locations, and the reasons that they found out about them is because the perpetrators, or the, you know, people who were part of the groups that committed the crimes, told them, you know, the secret, because they were really annoyed because they didn't get their cut of the booty, you know. So they made a deal that when they go to wars, you know. So they kept this, you know, they were annoyed with their partners in crime, right? And then they decided, you know, that was their motivation. So this is, you know, so this war economy kind of spills into the issues of transitional justice, you know. So you have, all of a sudden, you do find where these locations are, sort of that leads to some sort of, you know, sort of the families of the, you know, the missing find out, you know, where the remains are. But this has nothing to do really with reconciliation. It just has to do with the settling of those scores and those sort of war economics kind of spilling over into the peacetime. But that was on the economic side. Yelena, also the issue.
Just make a very, very quick point about this entire kind of state versus societal responsibility, and I would in general agree with Yelena that this is the ideal way and the fastest way that this would happen, is that the state leads and the society follows. But I have very strong doubts that that is possible actually in the Balkans, given that the governments in the Balkans are populistic and they're responsive rather than being progressive, and that the only way that this is going to happen in the Balkans is that if the society leads and is followed by the state, which is why it's such a problem that the funding for civil society organizations that are dealing with these issues is weakening, because they're the ones who are leading the society towards the point that will be able to affect the change in the state position. And in that sense, the answer to the question whether it's possible to have the change in society without the change of the state, I would argue that that's the only way it can happen in the Balkans, that the society has to change first, and that change will be reflected in the state.
James, you want to say something?
I do. I'm almost conscious of the time.
First I wanted to say my dream archive is that of the of an archive that can be accessible, which was for practical purposes, but is there. Might want to say something. About the archive that will be available, that is available, don't think that it's everything. It is not, and it will not be, all the material that has gone through the hands of any part of the Yugoslavia tribunal. There is a mass of material that will pretty certainly never see the light of day. It will be
Our dream archives, and in that sense, I mean, we can talk about a process that's beginning rather than entering a new phase. Was that short enough?
Yeah.
Okay. After the Hague Tribunal, more Hague Tribunal. And with that, I'd like to thank Jeffrey for responding in that way. My fellow panelists for being so good, humiliating me, and Denisa for organizing it.
Thank you, James.
I just want to make a point, aren't we, to go back to reconciliation, because we are now completely refocused our discussion on transitional justice, and we kind of neglected a little bit the reconciliation in all of this, and to what extent does transitional justice actually contribute to reconciliation, and whether it contributes, or whether perhaps, as some of the people I've spoken to are pointing out, all this digging in the past is not allowing people to move forward. To what extent are we keeping the conflict alive by deciding externally that this is what needs to be addressed, and to what extent are we actually listening to people living in those countries, what they need to be addressed? And I also want to say, aren't we expecting too much too soon? And who is the one who is going to decide? Shouldn't the people in the ground decide what reconciliation should be and what they should get as support externally to achieve that?
Okay, well, I think it's all pretty much been said. I would just like to refer once again to what I said earlier, and that we're talking about a process, and I think my colleagues here have highlighted that too. It's not something that finishes. It doesn't finish either on the justice or the reconciliation side, certainly not with the tribunal. And I think, obviously, as we can see from other cases, and we've evoked Nuremberg and others, this is obviously something that will be done over time. What I think is important to emphasize, though, is that it doesn't get done on its own. you have to have actors who are actually pushing this forward, and this is also something that Yelena emphasized. And I think the question is, how do you support and help those actors, and what kinds of activities can they produce to move the debate forward?
Okay, so all I can do is thank to all our contributors tonight, all the speakers, and thank you for your excellent questions, and Jeffrey Nice for his contribution as well. I'm sure this debate will continue. Thank you very much.